Welcome into Studio B. I am your host, Dan Long. Really briefly here, just because there's a lot to get to, I want to set up this conversation I had with the crew from Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's the latest and my most anticipated in a series of, if you want to call them reboots, that Netflix is doing. They're continuing to bring back these established properties and letting their creators loose and, you know, come up with new installments. And Mystery Science Theater 3000, you know it, it's the show with a guy and two robots. They sit in the theater silhouette and they make fun of cheesy B-movies. And it really created and perfected the art of movie riffing. You know, you're throwing jokes and comebacks and references up against what's being shown on the screen. The series returns Friday, April 14th on Netflix. It's technically the 11th season. It's a continuation of the old show, but also a rebirth of sorts. Jonah Ray steps in as the host. We see some new faces, hear some new voices, along with some familiarity. So we'll get into this conversation. And I do want to point out, at one point, they make a joke about meeting at an Eyes Wide Shut party that, in the heat of the moment, you know, sometimes stuff flies over your heads. And it flew completely over my head, and I look like an idiot. But I left it in just because it was a good line. Anyway, let's get started. Mystery Science Theater 3000, let's hear all about it right now.
In the not-too-distant future, next Sunday.
Mystery Science Theater 3000 ran on Comedy Central and Sci-Fi Network from 1989 to 99, 197 episodes. It's a tale as old as time. A guy stranded in space with two robots forced to watch bad movies as part of an evil scientist's experiment. The show that helped shape a lot of senses of humor from my generation and the generations kind of around mine is coming back. 11th season hits Netflix sometime this spring. Brand new episodes. They're currently in the middle of a series of premiere events exclusive to Kickstarter backers. They're heading into the Music Box Theater on the day this is recorded tonight to screen the first new episode for Chicago MST3K fans. Hashtag, we brought back MST3K. With me, we have creator, executive producer Joel Hodgson.
Hello. Yay.
New host Jonah Ray.
Hi.
Crow T Robot, Hampton Yunt.
Hello.
And Tom Servo, Baron Vaughn.
Hello.
How you guys doing?
Very well.
You didn't let him finish.
You know, yeah.
I was going to go on for another 10 seconds.
Do it again. Yeah, I don't want to.
Hello.
Goodbye. Beautiful. Will we be hearing some musical
no,
talents
it.
Of Servo? That's it?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Nothing else. Everything else is just chicken scratch. Doesn't make any sense.
Very nice. So here we are. It's kind of the culmination of a long journey from the beginning of the crowdfunding campaign almost a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So the show got funded. Rewards are now rolling out. The episodes are written, shot, cut, in the can, ready for people to watch. Snapshot this moment for me right now. What's going through everyone's mind?
Fire. It's pain, blood.
Dad.
Dad.
Oh, man. Well, we're actually relieved because we did the first premiere two nights ago in New York, and we got to show it. That was most nerve-wracking because we've only seen it amongst ourselves, obviously, and getting to show it to people who, you know, paid for the show, helped us make the show, and are obviously really invested in it. So that was the most scary part, and they seemed to like it, so we're happy about that.
Yeah, before the screening, what was going through my head was absolute fear and terror. Now there's absolute fear, terror, and hope.
But that little bit of hope kind of makes all the difference.
It really
though, doesn't
does.
It? Where there's a will, there's a way.
Because I was kind of coming in today like, oh, this should be, you know, New York went great. We can kind of have a little more like finesse going in when we set up the movie, and they're going, no, this is Chicago. This is completely different. This could all go bad.
Yeah.
So. You guys have a hardened sensibility out here.
Yeah,
I guess that's one way to put it. Have any of you ever been to the Music Box before?
No. Heard great things.
I've seen a lot of images from it. It looks super cool.
Yeah, it's a great place. I think you'll enjoy just being there.
But I don't think we could have known how good the New York show was going to go. We just kind of underwhelmed our expectations just to be sure, and it was amazing.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Were they able to come up to you kind of after the screening and give a little feedback?
Oh, yeah.
We had a cocktail party afterwards for the backers, and there were probably 400 people there. We got to meet almost all of them.
Yeah.
And we took questions after the screening, you know.
My measure of success is the amount of selfies I take in a night. And that was a pretty
of yourself,
pretty...
of like how many, how good you're feeling. So yes. How many selfies you take of
I take selfies of so myself.
On that scale, where were we?
Yeah, exactly. Probably somewhere between one and John Cho.
What a weird reference.
Because he was on a show called Selfie.
Oh.
Yeah. Pop culture references. That's what MST's about.
Yeah. You know, Selfie, the Karen Gill and John Cho vehicle that was like canceled. Of the Shrew, but told him to modern
No, no,
age.
it was Pygmalion.
Oh, it wasn't?
Yeah, My Fair Lady. Anyway, that's beside the point. The point is, people had a good
My
time.
Fair Lady first.
Anyway, this has been a promo for Selfie, a show that was on 2 years ago.
It went really well. People had a good time. They shook hands. There were hugs. People were happy. They were relieved.
Relieved.
Feuds were settled.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. The Hatfields, the McCoys, away. They put their stuff down.
Yeah, that was a big part because it's, you know, just as I would be if I wasn't involved, I'd be skeptical of what's been changed, what's different. And that was a... You know, I so much that night, it was just guys going like, listen, when you were announced, let's just say I'm very delighted.
A couple backhanded compliments, maybe.
I'm just hoping I can get the same. Everyone wants to be Jonah.
I'm just hoping I can get the same
kind
of
response. Everybody wants to be trapped on a satellite watching bad movies.
You got my dream job, man, but you did okay.
Joel, this story kind of starts with you getting the rights to MST3K back after kind of a what seemed like a kind of a protracted legal battle with whatever the remnants of the original Best Brains holding company was.
It wasn't a legal battle at all. It was just mostly getting organized and figuring out who did what. And so fortunately, I got to partner up with Shout Factory, who have this long history of working with the brand, and the fans really love what they've done with it. So that made it much easier, and they have a lot of experience, obviously, with licensing and all that stuff. So that helped a lot, but it just took a long time. Am I missing part? I'm trying to remember if there's any other part of that question.
Well, just the journey from, like, starting with getting the rights back then moving forward.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, when we started, we kind of felt like this is a long time ago. This is it must have been 7 or 8 years ago when we started talking about it. And I think at that time we just assumed it would be a reunion show. But then when I really sat down and tried to organize, what would that be? Like, how do you deal with two hosts, Mike and Joel?
Right.
How do you do two sets of Toms, two sets of Crows? Like, the only thing that made sense is like a parallel universe show that you cut between.
Build two shows.
Yeah, but so ultimately that didn't work. That didn't seem practical. And then I kind of hit on the idea of, oh, why don't we just roll over the cast and bring in new people, and then the original cast can visit, you know? So that kind of became the model for it, and that seemed to function really well, and that's kind of where we're at now.
So who's the first cast? Did you say, okay, now I have to find a host, and then...
Yeah, it was Jonah, and we met through the Nerdist podcast.
Yeah, Joel was a guest on the Nerdist podcast kind of early on, it was 5 years ago.
Yep.
That you were on it, and you know, I was a huge fan then, and so we were very excited to talk to him. And then I ended up running into Joel like a couple other times that weekend. Once at a Wayne White art show, and then the next night at a Harmontown taping at Meltdown Comics in L.A.
And that Eyes Wide Shut party.
That Eyes Wide Shut party, but we didn't know. You know, we didn't find
didn't
out we were both
were
there.
I didn't know you were that guy.
That was
on that staircase. That was you.
That was me. It's so funny. We found that out later that we were at the same Eyes Wide Shut party.
But the thing was is
how'd you and your mom meet? Well,
why'd they make that dog wear that mask?
Yeah, out of context, we met at an Eyes Wide Shut party could mean a whole lot of things.
I started to think about Jonah. We got to write together. I actually Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub are both friends of ours, and they were doing the award
That's
show?
That's the award show for Channel 101, their long-running, you know.
The Channies.
Yeah,
so they wanted me to present, and I think I was working on other space, so I was really busy, and I didn't have a lot of time, but I thought, man, it would be fun to write with Jonah and see what he's like to write with. So he helped me write jokes, and we worked together really good. He's easy to write with, fun to hang out with, and that's when I really started thinking seriously, like, oh, maybe he could be the guy. And so I eventually asked him. I can't believe how long it's been, though, like 4 or 5 years ago.
So it was 5 years ago we met, and then you would talk. We just kind of became friends over a year, and then it was about a year. So 4 years ago is when you kind of brought it up.
Yeah, and so and then I just said, if we ever get to do this, I think you should be the guy. And then about 2 years ago, I guess, or I said, We got to get Tom Servo and Crow. Who do you want? Because I just felt like it would be a mistake for me to try to cast those guys and then go, I hope the chemistry works out.
Right.
Whoever I pick, they should be cool. And so it made sense for Jonah to kind of pick Baron and Hampton. But why don't you talk about that?
Well, yeah, when he asked me, it didn't really take long for me to figure out who I thought would be best. Hampton, you know, he has the timbre in his voice and his style of comedy is always it's already very close to the sensibility I find in Crow, which is, you know, like kind of, you know, unhinged and delighted by chaos. And
plus, I bribed you.
Yeah.
Really helped seal the deal.
It was great. It was the best $25, like, 'cause it was like free money.
Ice cream sandwich
with you know, Tom Servo. You know, I don't know anyone that there's no one that sounds like Kevin Murphy. Kevin Murphy is like, it's like he has a voice that will always only be Kevin Murphy's.
Yeah.
But then I started to kind of think about, you know, the type of character Tom is, which is, you know, he's like very pompous. He's he loves to sing. He loves to do Shakespearean monologues. And I was like, that's exactly describing my friend Baron.
Yeah, the truth is that James Earl Jones said no. And then I was a close number two after Tilda Swinton.
Yeah. She can play anything.
She can do anything.
You mentioned before just kind of a sense of relief, you said, after the New York premiere. I mean, you're the host. You're kind of the, you know, the point guard of this thing on air. Describe a little bit of the pressure coming in, especially for a gig that was at one point one of the more hotly contested things on the Internet. You know, Joel versus Mike. Then I think back to, I don't know if you've ever seen the first episode of Conan O'Brien's Late Night, where they cold open, where he's walking through the streets of New York, and walking through like kids and hot dog vendors are going, a lot of pressure, man. You better be as good as Letterman.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, a little bit of that.
There's that especially. I mean, both of them are. So I know that if I do anything as the third host, we'll finally just kind of stop the arguments about who's better. It will unite the fans of Joel and Mike in a mutual hatred of me. Maybe. But like,
who's the guy that you said would be like the perfect collage of Mike and me?
Oh, I remember
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
It wasn't TJ Miller.
Yeah, it's TJ.
Oh, TJ, that's right.
Yeah, you were saying TJ Miller, but
yeah. Everyone listening and they're like, "Oh, only if." The Slim Jim guy. Yeah, it was, you know, it's scary, but and it's a lot of pressure because I know what people think, because I'm a fan too, it's like if it was anybody else besides me, I would hate that person. I would be upset, and you know, when it comes to people like being upset at like another new guy, I kind of go, well, no, I get it. How do you think I feel? I can't complain about the new guy, you know?
Right.
And in a way, I almost feel like it's them just saying they almost have confidence in you, but in a backhanded way of just like, hey, don't mess it up because I want this to be working. And
yeah,
I want this to
I
go
get
well.
A lot of quotes from a lot of references to Airplanes. Like, we're all counting on you. Don't screw this up. You know?
But a big thing that people forget is that Joel is here. I feel like, you know, what happens when shows like this or become, you know, redone, that sometimes it's taken by people who have no knowledge of the history of the show, couldn't care less about what they're trying to do as much as they're using a name to kind of make something that people recognize. But here we all love the show. We're all being faithful to what the show is about, you know, just. And so Joel, the calm,
Joel's been our spirit
zen
guide.
Hand of Joel Hodgson.
Yeah. He's got the Midwestern zen.
One thing I was going to say, though, too, is if this was done by, like, some Hollywood hotshot who they hired.
Those slick Hollywood hogs.
Yeah, so they, like, go.
I got a couple ideas.
Some hired gun who says, okay, I can do this, but I got 6 months. And it's, like, the difference between, like, 7 years.
You know,
just thinking about it, trying to get ready for it, negotiating it and all that. So it is a little different. In that regard, like speaking to what Baron's saying, the traditional way they reboot a show, it's a little different.
This is more personal. This time,
it's personal.
Yeah, if it was some other entity remaking the show, you know, it would be Adrian Grenier would be the host, and Turtle would be the voice of Tom Servo.
Yeah.
And Johnny Drama would be. I like how I used one real name, and then I just used a character's name.
Crow would have abs.
Yeah. In the not-too-distant future, oh, yeah! With that Sunday AD, oh, yeah!
Baron and Hampton, you guys have kind of a different challenge in that you're inhabiting these characters that the audience already knows and already has some kind of connection to. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about your approach to that a little bit. Did you try to find kind of a common thread between Trace Crowe, Corbett Crowe, yeah, and what I can do as a comic, and then, you know, Josh Servo, Kevin Servo, what I can do as a comic?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I played around with what voice it was I was doing for a while, but it came down to just deciding that I knew what Servo is about.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then also the qualities that people identify as Servo qualities, that I knew I could inhabit those certain things, you know.
Yeah, it's so more about keeping the spirit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's about keeping the spirit, you know. And then another important thing is the chemistry, you know, that Hampton and Jonah and I know each other really well. You know, we've hung out. We can
know each
other kind of
for like close to 10 years. Yeah,
yeah, we can riff off each other. So, and that's the spirit of the show, is people that have that kind of, we know where each other can go with all that stuff. Like an improv troupe.
Yeah.
Except the suggestion,
like a second
is space.
City. Yeah, and it's like my voice maybe is a little close to Crow's, so I play with that. You know, like I can just do like close to Crow's,
yeah,
sounding voice.
But
so
I can hear
like
it just
well,
listening
know?
To you now. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
But, you know, the main point is to just keep the character sensibility there, you know, because
right,
we grew up watching the show. So we are very informed to not betray, you know, the version we grew up watching, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, like, even when I was on the stage and, like, we'd be doing these host bits, there would be times I'm like, I would say a line. I was like, oh, that just sounds like something like how Joel would have said it, or how Mike would have said something. I would catch myself even there in that spot, because there's like, you know, there's the two. That's the two references I have.
Right.
Like, how to be in yeah, that position.
Because you want to pay your respects, you know?
Yeah.
You want to be... These people are our heroes in a lot of different ways. So we are influenced by them and model ourselves after them in some sort of way. But we are ourselves now, as heady as that sounds.
Yeah.
We wanted to be them, but now we realize that we're us. And so we're us doing the thing that they did. Okay, cleared it up. Back to the Eyes Wide Shut party.
The other thing I was going to say is there's so many people that are working on this show. And I think of Elliot Kalin, who's our head writer, who's like... He really loves MST, and he's like helping us kind of care for it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So there's a lot of that going on, I think, too, where it's like these guys all have great ideas and are so talented, and at the same time they want to kind of keep it going and keep it kind of healthy in its own way. So that's at work too, I think. It's not so much on me as it is on all of us, just to kind of like, well, what do we know about it, and where does it need to go, you know?
Right. And I was, as the guy who I would assume has the final say, you know, when Jonah brought these guys to you, what was it about them that kind of made it click in your head? They're like, okay, well, these guys can be my Crow and Servo.
Well, I had never seen them perform, so Jonah sent me links to them, like, doing stand-up, and I just really loved them right away, and just, like, I think it was that thing, like, for Hampton, it was that bit where you go the... You talk about the newsreaders and the way
oh,
they do
really?
That.
I didn't know
that bit?
Yeah,
can you do some of that for us? Oh, no. But it would be so fun if we watched
yeah.
you. But anyway, he did this bit that just I thought was so great. And Baron, for me, what really got me was he did an impression of Bowie, which really just got me. And I go, who does an impression of Bowie? And it's just like it made me really like him. So I signed off on him right away. Again, it wouldn't have mattered what I thought of him, because Jonah has to. The thing that so few people think about when you're in that spot is there's a lot of pressure because you're the only person, and it's kind of like you have robots, but the host is doing a lot of emoting for everybody.
Right,
they're kind of inanimate, and so there's a lot of pressure being on camera, so I just wanted to look out for him, and if he felt comfortable with these guys, that was good enough for me.
It did help quite a bit, you know, jumping into something like this where I would sometimes get overwhelmed with the idea of that it actually happened, to have two old friends that, like, I came up in comedy with. Right there with me, it meant a lot.
The whole experience was fun. Like, this
yeah.
is the best show I've ever worked on.
Yeah.
It was the most fun I've had working on anything. You know, we were just, like, riffing and having
yeah,
a bunch of fun trying to crack each other up.
Yeah.
That's it, you know?
So was it difficult, though, trying to translate that chemistry, like, you three as human beings, to chemistry between Jonah, on the satellite, loving the two and Crow and Servo.
Well, I don't. I've never thought of these guys as human beings.
He doesn't treat us like it either.
You know, there was this interesting. It was. I had an interesting experience when we were filming all the host segments, where it's just like, I'm looking at Servo and I'm, you know, using this radio controller to move his mouth, which was a great thing that happened in this new season where we had these controllers where we could control the mouths of the puppets. So that way, any improv or any, like, you know, emotional sounds we wanted to make, we could make the mouths move. But I'm watching Servo and it's like, I'm not him, you know? So I'm like watching him and I'm thinking of everything that this bot would say as opposed to what I would say. And it was interesting seeing Jonah like look at the bots.
Yeah.
Cause even when we weren't filming, I was still in the bot thing and he's like having conversations with the bot. It's and, like him, we and then him going like, wait, this is a show.
It's like we were watching a show, but controlling a show at the same time. You know what I mean? It's
very odd. My dreams.
Yeah. And I was Mike TV just jumping right into it.
And I was Max Headroom.
So take me through the writing process a little bit, just because it seems like it's different from the old show in that you have, you know, you used a lot of guest writers coming in and people working remotely. Is it hard to get into a groove like that and foster kind of a cohesive environment?
We figured it out pretty quickly, and we did it a couple of methods. It's different than the way we wrote the show originally, because when we did the show originally, everybody who wrote on the show lived like within 15 miles of my house, and so it made it much easier to get together and write. And now everybody lives all over the place, and we have writers in the East Coast, the West Coast, Midwest. And so we had two methods. One was just doing a writing group via Skype and watching the video together and riffing, which is kind of more the traditional model, how we used to write the show. And we broke into two groups, and I had a group, and Elliot and Jonah had a group, and they would run the movies and riff on them and gather riffs that way. And also another really big part of it is everyone writing remotely alone with the movie, which is kind of a new thing that came out of doing Cinematic Titanic, because when we did Cinematic Titanic, which I did with the original cast of the show with Mary Jo Trace and Frank and Josh Weinstein, we wrote them all remotely and then gathered all the riffs together and individually would produce a section. And so we did that method too, which I really like, because there's kind of a tyranny of the group when you write, and it's kind of who's the loudest, who's the fastest.
Right. Yeah. Somebody might hold something back.
Yeah, and I'm not, and I don't always want to do that. So when you do it remotely, you can just think about it. It's a little more like knitting or something.
Yeah.
So those two methods, but then there's all these other layers when we get the list of riffs and these guys start working with it, and then they bring stuff to it and improvise stuff on top of that. And there's all these amazing guttural noises that come out that aren't in the script, and reactions to things on screen. So
Hampton was always really great at that. It was always like when someone was explaining something, like just pure exposition, and Hampton would just have the other character going,
And those are the little details that matter sometimes. You know, just little grunts and stuff is what.
That's like the final icing on the cake. The grunts. You know?
Little grunts. Little grunts. That's what got us all here to this place.
But yeah, it was really cool to just be always able to kind of refine the jokes, you know, throughout the entire process. And
yeah,
like you said, Joel, old show, obviously everybody kind of in one place in Minneapolis, the area anyway, and that kind of Midwestern feel was a big part of the show's identity during the original run. Did you guys ever find yourselves trying to replicate that, either consciously or subconsciously, or did you know, I guess, was it easy to mix stuff in from your own background?
Well,
yeah, I remember going.
That's like the vibe of the show. I always felt like when watching as a kid, it's like, oh, they riff about stuff that they know about and that's local to them.
Yeah.
So in the same way, when I was a kid, just joking with my friends, it's like, we'd make references to things we knew.
Yeah, but I wrote in some Hawaii-specific references that were not used.
Too many vowels.
Yeah, it's like wow, this traffic on the Kalani Aniole Highway is, and they're like, no, it seems like you're making fun of something.
That's something I could have a mini ha-ha about.
I think, too, that we did put some stuff in about the Midwest just as kind of a look back. There's a fair amount of riffs that we acknowledge are from the old show. In the new show, there's a lot of Easter eggs that kind of harken back to
callbacks to old stuff.
So we do that a fair amount, but the truth be told, you know, when these guys were all like 13, when they found the show, they all drank our Kool-Aid, our Midwest Kool-Aid.
Flavored
which is milk.
So it's in there. Yeah.
Raw which is, milk.
Which they call baby cheese curds.
Yeah. Jonah, I know you grew up in Hawaii. Hampton Baron, where are you guys from?
I'm from Virginia.
He says with so much pride.
I'm not.
I know. That's what you're like. I'm no, Virginia. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada.
I guess kind of a practical question here. How did you decide how to pace the show now that, you know, you're on Netflix, no commercial breaks, which was, I guess, helpful in a way because it kind of helped you structure, you know, what you were going to cut out of the movie and, you know, what the host segments would be. Are you still going to try and keep the structure of the show and keep it at kind of a runtime of 90 minutes, more or less?
Yeah, it's 90 minutes with the credits. And there is breaks in it. There's bumpers. Because Kinga, who's Dr. Forster's daughter, who's now running the experiment, is very ambitious and is trying to blow up the brand and sell it to Disney for $1 billion. So she's constantly hyping the show. So there are breaks, just like there were commercial breaks, where she'll embellish and talk about herself or talk about what's going on at Moon 13, where her hideout is. So she's kind of doing the same kind of hype that a local TV station would. That
okay,
so
stick around.
It's still in there. Yeah, it's still kind of like I think she thinks it's like the Tonight Show. There's like a band and stuff like that.
Okay,
so she yeah. She's doing those same TV kind of things,
which is pretty great because her character really is an awesome way to talk about, you know, TV in general and the business of TV and a way to kind of crack jokes at the monetization of entertainment.
It's like we're self-acknowledging that it's a reboot. You know,
everything,
that
everything's about the brand. And
exactly.
One of my favorite parts of the show, and I think the part that I think is the easiest way to get new people into it was to show them the shorts, which, you know, they're a little more compact. It's shorter, so the, you know, the joke density is a little bit higher. A little bit more digestible than sitting through Manos, The Hands of Fate. Without asking any specifics, can we expect any tips on how to stay clean and respect our parents?
Oh, man. I don't want to say. I want to leave that as a surprise.
That's fair.
I also don't want to close my eyes. I don't want to fall asleep.
Closing your eyes.
Yeah.
Closing your eyes. Don't want
to miss a thing. Britannica.
Educational shorts and you.
Just from reading through the press release and some of Joel's like Kickstarter updates, it looks like there's going to be some variation of an invention exchange back, and there's going to be kind of that spirit, that emphasis on kind of building stuff and tinkering that was present in Joel's original run on the show. Jonah, are you a handy guy, or who's the point man that handles a lot of that stuff?
I'm kind of a little gizmocrat, you know. It's like I have a little maker studio, fab lab, in the so I do like, you know, laser cut stuff on wood, and I'm always making something. I'm always kind of tinkering, and we did bring back the invention exchange, and so I always have something to kind of that I've built. Of course, by I mean the character, not me specifically.
We wrote a segment for the show.
Yeah.
The actual person, only destroys things.
Yeah, but it's neat, and it was a great device, I think, that Joel came up with, where it's so if there's stuff that's like newer or unfamiliar to people in this new series, it's because like I'm a builder and I was able to make stuff. I was able to tweak things.
Right.
So it was a great way to kind of incorporate a few different ideas into progressing the show forward.
Oh, yeah. The exposition in the show, it's probably the better thing. It's probably the best thing. Like, the riffs are really good, but exposition is the best.
We laid it on. Thick and rich.
Honestly, we tell Batman's origin story inside.
Yeah. A few times.
Pilot, a couple times.
You tell the origin story of the people who wrote the origin story.
Baron, I know you've done some stuff with Leonard Maltin.
Yes.
He awarded the Laser Blast 2 stars. Would any of you guys consider yourselves film buffs? Like, were you aware of B movies and stuff growing up?
Sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of these movies that I saw on the show, a lot of them was the first time I'd ever seen them. But I definitely was watching. I mean, I'm a child of cable.
Yeah.
So I definitely was watching horrible movies on all the different channels all
your first album is called Raised on Cable.
My first album, yeah, my first album, my first apple is called Green, but sorry, Granny, but my all right, Granny Smith?
No, don't.
I didn't have the luxury of cable. I wasn't a rich boy like Barron growing up.
A rich boy.
You had to make cable at home.
Out of bits of wire I'd find. But I remember watching a lot of Paramount 20. Channel 20. That was where you'd find just midday movies, and they would play like weird horror movies, weird
stuff. That's a Virginia thing, right?
It's, I guess, because that's what they had, a theme park, King's Dominion. It was all tied into Paramount, you know, Channel 20.
You're watching hillbilly television.
You're watching hillbilly TV. Take your tooth out. It's hillbilly TV.
It'll tickle your innards.
Turn that bucket over and sit down for some hillbilly TV. Yeah, I used to. I remember when I, like, it was kind of the movie that really got me into, like, Mystery Science Theater got me into, like, watching these movies, but I didn't know how to find them. But then I was seeing, getting into the movie Ed Wood, when I saw that movie, like, I was like, I want to know everything about this guy and these movies and these people. And then it just kind of, I would, you know, try and find books that would mention, you know, the Ed Wood or Bela Lugosi. And then that's how I started really digging in deep, going to the video store and just basically going into the horror section and going tape by tape. Every time I went, I would just go get the one that was the next one down.
Nice.
Yeah. Leprechaun 1, Leprechaun 2. That's it.
Let's talk about comedy a little bit. I mean, obviously, Mystery Science Theater 3000. But who are some of your other guys, you know, that you looked up to, and how did you get into comedy? Mm. Go across the board.
Me first?
Yeah.
I got the best answer. Start the other way. No. I mean, you know, watching Mystery Science Theater 3000, it was on the comedy, you know, channel and Comedy Central. So there was all this different stand-up that was on all the time. So I was constantly taking in stand-up. I mean, my biggest influences, I would probably say, are Richard Pryor and Steve Martin. So I'm right in the middle of them.
I was obsessed with Comedy Central when it came out. Like, my hero growing up was Mel Brooks. You know, I was trying really hard and running all over the island to try and find. I wanted to own each and every one of his movies, and then I couldn't find 12 Chairs because it was out of print. And then right when I had a line in on one, I wrote letters to like video stores on the mainland. To try and get it, and then like right when I had a line on one, they released the box set of all the Mel Brooks movies, and I was like, "Oh!"
That's great.
But yeah, he, like, you know, like Mel Brooks, Weird Al, Kids in the Hall, were all like just like my favorite things, because I liked with Mel Brooks and, you know, Kids in the Hall, especially. Kids in the Hall was like so like cinematic with their sketches.
Yeah,
You know, it wasn't like perfectly structured sketch comedy. But, you know, they would be doing parodies of Eraserhead, and it was like also very musical, felt very punk rock, and it kind of started to align with all my interests, and so that was a very big part of when I was growing up.
And you kind of came up with that punk kind of DIY mentality, I guess, because you drummed in a punk band or something, didn't you?
I play drums in like a ton of punk bands and hardcore bands growing up, and it, you know, it's the idea of, it's like, don't wait for permission to do anything. Just go and put it together yourself. Don't worry if it's perfect. Don't worry if it's, you know, if everyone's going to like it. Because if it's a way for you to kind of express yourself creatively, then just go and do it. And you'll figure it out as you do it. And, I mean, that seeing Mystery Science Theater, or just like, you know, it was a sci-fi show, but it was just like kind of put together with, you know, glue and cardboard. And that was like a huge thing to see. You know, the idea that, like, oh, this is attainable. This is I could figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, when you see the strings, you kind of go, oh, okay, yeah, I know how to figure
this
out.
I could be Mel Brooks.
I didn't know our answers. Still on my way. I didn't know our answers could be this long. Let's come back to me. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, happy.
Skip Joel.
Well, I didn't have
yes, the
so thing. I found the show through just friends and my brother. Like, you know, they turned me on to it, you know. But other than that, Simpsons was a big deal, of course, when I was growing up. But I was also, like, really into comic books. So I'd get into really silly comic books, like Asterix and Obelix. Have you ever heard of these things?
Sure.
Like, I was obsessed with these. And they're full of puns and full of, like, weird geography gags and stuff like that. And, like, totally, like, historical jokes. And it was, like, my bread and butter growing up and, like, you know, Calvin and Hobbes, and just kind of like goofy, thoughtful comics were really my thing.
Farside?
Yeah, I had all of them.
Nice. Getting
What'd you say?
Peanuts?
Almonds?
Peanuts. I don't know. Now more recently. Because if you go back and read the original.
Doesn't get any funny than Family
incredible.
Circus.
It's good. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
Getting back to the idea of just kind of coming across things on cable, you know, with the way streaming and Netflix is set up, you know, you don't really have that mode of kind of flipping around and accidentally stumbling upon something. All you get is, you know, a thumbnail and maybe the title that you can scroll through. How do you guys want to approach getting more people to discover the show that so you're not just catering to the same people who were fans of the old show?
Well, I think it's actually much better because I think the idea is that there's an algorithm that says, oh, these people like science fiction, these people like comedy, let's suggest this to them. Whereas before you were just dependent on kind of looking through tons and tons and tons of stuff. And, you know, it's got its own charms because that's how we used to acquire stuff. And, I mean, I'm an advocate of that too. But I'm hoping that in some ways, you know, Mystery Science Theater in its own way has never really been famous. It's, like, got a lot of people that love it, but they all had to kind of get it the hard way and tape it, like, when it was on a midnight on a, you know, on a Tuesday night. Or, you know, we were on every time of the day except prime time, you know. And so what I'm looking forward to is finally, you know, people can watch it after dinner, you know. It's like they can go watch Mystery Science Theater and kind of tuck in, and it's there for them. So that's the thing that I've always missed. Like, it's always on the outskirts. It's always on the periphery. And so now it's kind of like right alongside these other great shows. So maybe more people will find it.
Nice. And I guess I kind of glanced over this in my notes. I forgot I did not mention anything about, obviously, the Mads. Patton Oswalt is son of TV's Frank.
TV's son
of, yeah. And Felicia Day is Kinga Forrester.
They're both so good. Yeah. It's so fun to watch them together.
Well, and what was the chemistry like there, you know, between you guys and the Mads?
Well, you know, it's the way the show shot, like, and that was how you guys did it before,
yeah,
right?
We never were doing it at the same time. Yeah.
So, it was really fun because we shot our stuff on different days. And so there was that, you know, like, it's like, because, like, the set for the Mads faces one way and the satellite set is the other way.
All in one room.
Okay.
One room.
Yeah.
And we only have one camera. So
yeah.
Flip it, you know.
Yeah. It's part of that disconnect, like, felt real and like they're in a base and you're in a satellite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I went to set to watch them and it was awesome. Like, you know, Felicia, I had kind of known here and there over the years, but I had no idea how strong she was comedically, and she's such a great performer. And Patton plays TV's son with such a
joy range.
It's kind of vaudeville at times where he, like, never knows which direction to leave, like, the camera angle.
Yeah.
I love that stuff.
I mean, I don't want to say too much, but he has this amazing gravity when he came on the set. I was even a little intimidated, and I was like going, how's Felicia going to handle this? And she just, like, met him right at the level and even tried to dominate him, and it was really strong. Yeah. So there, that was, like, another, like, amazing thing to see happen, because all I knew is, wow, I love Patton and I love Felicia, but I've never seen them do anything together. Yeah. We don't know if this is going to work out, but it did.
I guess the goal, I would imagine, I guess, is to eventually have this be kind of a self-sufficient operation in terms of funding, you know, and going beyond these initial 14 episodes. Am I right?
Yeah. We have a really great relationship with the backers. They did this amazing thing. We hope they have a good experience, and we're going to keep that going as long as we can, and as long as they're happy doing it, we're going to keep offering cool rewards and stuff like that. But it only comes after we deliver everything we said we're going to deliver.
Right.
Once we get that, then we can talk about other things. But I think the premise is in success, if it goes well for this first season, we'll get other seasons from Netflix and keep that going. But in the event that ever stops, we can always go back to the backers if they had a good experience.
Right.
Hat in hand, growling.
Yeah, going, well, that's why we're being so nice to them now. We've got to think about the next time.
The money.
The next
thing.
Speaking of the backers, the Bring Back MST3K Kickstarter set a world record, highest funded film and TV crowdfunding campaign in history. Was it a surprise to you that kind of support came out?
Well, personally, And this might be just that I'm naive and like positive or something, but I always thought that I was gonna. We wanted to do 12 episodes. We wanted to get 12 episodes total, and I was kind of expecting that, because if you don't go all the way, if you don't get a full series, what is it then? Is it just like 6 episodes, and then you have to go somewhere else and get the rest of them? So I was kind of expecting that to happen, but then to go beyond that, that really shocked me. The idea of that in the last 8 hours, we got enough to make 2 more episodes.
Yeah,
yeah.
That totally freaked me out. I didn't see that coming. No, at all.
I haven't come down from that high.
You're still,
dude, I'm still lifting.
I remember because there was the end of the Kickstarter telethon thing, and I was on the road in Atlanta. So like I put together at a bar like a viewing party of it, and when it got to the 14 episodes, people were going crazy. It was like people were so excited, and it was so fun. Yeah.
That Kickstarter night had so many technical difficulties. Like, oh, we were amazed it all like came together, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was another really weird thing, because, again, we have to name check Ivan Asquith, who's kind of the genius behind our Kickstarter campaign. And that was his idea to do the telethon. And I just go, it seems like so much work. But he knew that it would focus everybody. And I think that in its own way, and somehow the technical difficulties,
it made it better.
It makes it memorable in a way.
Really weird, but yeah, and I was so frustrated going, why do we even do this? And then it actually all worked out, so I guess, you know.
What made it funnier.
Yeah, it made extra, like 2 extra shows.
So I'll leave you guys with this, I guess. Over $6 million, 50,000 backers, and a Netflix deal for a show that has been off the air for 18 years, more or less. Why do you guys think it's endured so long, kind of in the popular lexicon, and why are the fans still so passionate about it?
Can I go first?
Please.
I think it's because the show is basically like what it's like to joke with your friends when you're watching a bad movie, and it just is that fun spirit.
Yeah, I think with the popularity of podcasts, it shows that people kind of, you know, they want to be able to, you know, passively hang out with people. And that's
right.
Kind of what the show is, you know.
True.
You just you want to be social, but you also want to be a wallflower, just relax by yourself, and that's a big part of the show. It's a timeless thing. It's just, you know, it's a comfortable show, and it's a nice way to just kind of watch a bad movie with some friends.
It's also lived on in ways that weren't exactly the show, like shows that it influenced happened, mm-hmm. like its children and its grandchildren, and obviously a lot of comedians and writers were influenced by the show, so they kind of take that with them on whatever shows that they're. So it's like it's just been embedded in the culture in a way that I think people are surprised by sometimes, but I'm not.
Yeah,
I was going to say the thing. This is something that wasn't clear to me when I started it, but over years I started to understand about it. Is it carries its context with it. Which is weird, because if you look at a traditional show like The Daily Show or Conan or something, the whole purpose is to reflect what's happening now. And with Mystery Science Theater, it just reflects the movie back into itself. So that's why I think it travels through time so well. It's not like we're trying to load it with pop culture, like Trump.
It's not Murphy
jokes,
Brown.
Right.
That's
right.
I mean.
Yeah. Like we're not going, this bad movie needs a lot of, you know, Hillary jokes.
Yeah.
Even that sounds kind of old. It's only been like 2 months. It's like,
do we not have any?
Yeah.
Do
no,
we not have
didn't.
Any jokes
we don't
like
have
that
a
at
single
all?
Trump or Hillary joke. In
I feel
it.
Like
but
the old
like,
show had nothing but Reagan material.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of Reagan.
But even back then, they were
really kind of stayed away from that, and I think that's another reason why is there's not those things kind of reflecting the period in which they were made. So it kind of like. As long as you're watching the movie, you know what the deal is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, thank you guys so much. I hope we answered. I mean, I hope we covered everything.
Yeah, man.
I'll ask the Marin question. Are we good?
Are we good?
Yeah.
Is this WTF?
Is this all right? Oh, God, I'm sorry.
So we good.
Boomer!
Yeah. Are we cool?
Are we cool? You just got to sign off with,
Joel Hodgson, Jonah Ray, Baron Vaughn, Hampton Yunt, the cast and creator and executive producer and writers of Mystery Science Theater 3000, coming back, new episode, season 11, Netflix, spring 2017. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.